Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucksthesseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
When my kids were really little, we would go for these walks in our neighborhood, and there was a tree down the street that had this kind of gnarly knot on it that looked like an old man's ear. And at some point I said, why don't we whisper our secrets to the tree?
This is Keo McClear. She's a writer in Toronto. She says her two sons love the idea.
And they kind of sidled up to it, and they spoke for a long time. And I remember being kind of impressed by how many secrets they had to divulge. And it was kind of both interesting to me, but also kind of curious, because I thought they were really candid with me. And I thought, what is it that they're now telling this tree? But anyway, we continued with this ritual for many years. And then when I discovered the secret that my parents had kept for me for so long, I started to have a different relationship to the tree, and I didn't want to stop there anymore, and I didn't want my sons to divulge their secrets to the tree, and I didn't want there to be secrets.
Keo moved to Toronto from London when she was 4 years old. Her parents told her she spent the whole plane ride walking up and down the aisles, talking to the other passengers. Keo's parents had been together for more than a decade. What was their relationship like when you were growing up?
I knew them to have a very tumultuous relationship. They could be quite tender with each other in some ways, but they weren't openly demonstrative. It was very combative. There were often really intense arguments and fights with, like, my mother was very dramatic at times and would kind of hurl, like, plates and pots around. And I'd remember feeling that there would be periods of calm, and then out of nowhere there'd be a kind of outburst.
Keo's mother, Mariko, met Keo's father, Michael, in Japan in the early 60s.
My father was stationed in Tokyo as a Far East correspondent for the CBC, and my mother was in her 20s, and she was quite kind of lovely and fetching, and she would hang out at these parties with these foreigners often, and she met my father at a party, I think it was for journalists. She didn't speak any English, and he spoke virtually no Japanese, but somehow a spark was lit, and they were also both interested in gambling, so they started playing Hanafuda, which is a game based on kind of poker, but it's flower-based cards. And they would bet and gamble together. And I think they just started to develop a friendship and then a relationship. They both really loved living the kind of high life. They went to casinos all the time. They played poker several times a week with friends. They loved traveling. My mother often accompanied my father on his trips.
Keo's parents told her that mixed-race couples were unusual at the time in Japan. When they went out, people would stare at them. Once, someone yelled at Michael to go home. Michael and Mariko got married and moved to London. Mariko worked as a tour guide, even though she wasn't very familiar with the city. She once led a tour group in circles around the Tower of London in the fog. Keo was born in London in 1970. In 1974, Michael got a new job with the CBC in Toronto.
My mother was very much a city girl. She loved London, and I think it was really a culture shock when she arrived in Canada. I mean, they arrived in the middle of winter in Toronto, and back then there was a real winter. They lived kind of in a suburban-ish area in Toronto, and everything was very far apart. It was kind of a neighborhood scene, but she felt very isolated. I think she was quite unhappy, and she would really miss the kind of cosmopolitan life of London and Tokyo.
Growing up, Kyo's father, Michael, was often away, traveling for work. When he was home, she remembers people often recognized him from TV. She and her father were close. When she was away at camp, he would write her letters in the voice of their pet cat. But Kyo says there were still a lot of things she didn't know about her father.
There were huge kind of areas of his life I knew nothing about. For example, he never really wanted to talk about his mother. Whenever I'd mention her name, he would really kind of clam up and just kind of get really sad, I guess. He had been given over to foster care at a very young age, so there was kind of reasons for that. But I really wanted to know more about that side of his family.
Kyo's mother often threatened to leave Michael. And once Mariko actually did leave, she went to Niagara Falls, but she came back the next day. While Kyo was away at college, she learned that her father had been having an affair.
And I just felt kind of riddled with guilt, and I didn't know. It just felt like a really kind of hot, burning secret. And it made it really hard for me to relate to my father. I just felt so guilty whenever I was with him that I was kind of betraying my mother in some way.
And then, a few months later, Mariko found out about the affair and that Michael had been seeing the same woman for years.
And it was very explosive again. I didn't know it at the time, but I think a lot of the arguments were based on things that were happening behind the scenes in my father's kind of love life. And eventually my father realized that it wasn't tenable anymore, and he just left.
Michael announced that he was separating from Mariko. Kyo remembers her mother called her father's co-workers to tell them about the affair. She threatened her father's girlfriend.
And it was awful, to be honest. My mother kind of fell into this deep depression, and I was so used to her moods, but I'd never seen her sad before, and it was really alarming to me. Eventually, she pulled herself out of it and had kind of a renaissance, like in her 50s, early 50s. She kind of started to socialize a lot and take up, you know, art again and go to classes and made all sorts of friends. But in the period right after he left, it was a really kind of desolate time for her. And it was really hard for me to witness her be so despairing, because I had always known her to be very strong and fiery. And this was another side to her.
Her parents never legally divorced, but they never lived together again. When Kyo was in her 40s, Michael had two strokes, and Kyo and her husband became his main caretakers. A few years later, they noticed that Michael was having trouble remembering things.
We had been noticing things that were kind of slipping. He was usually so, like, eloquent and, you know, verbally dexterous, and suddenly he was kind of missing words that were really commonplace. I remember, like, there reached a point where we just knew that something was going on.
Michael went to the doctor for a memory test and was diagnosed with dementia. He died in 2018.
You know, what I realized after he died was that there were a lot of holes in the narrative of his life. So I decided that I wanted to do a DNA test because I wanted to kind of reconnect with anyone who might have been part of that family. And so I thought, you know what, I'll do this test and maybe I'll find a cousin or somebody who might have known my father's mother and could tell me one story. Because all I had was one photograph of her, which was like the size of like a chocolate square. So a few months after my father died, I did this DNA test.
The DNA test came with a piece of paper with terms and conditions. It read, "You may discover unanticipated facts about yourself or your family when using our services that you may not have the ability to change." She mailed the test in and waited. And then she got an email. Her DNA results were ready.
It became quickly clear that there was something unexpected had arrived in my inbox.
I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love. We'll be right back. Support for This Is Love comes from Indeed. Sometimes a new person joining your team at work can make a good team into a great one. But finding the right person can be a challenge. Indeed helps you find that perfect match when you're looking to hire. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences for job candidates and becomes more accurate over time. So the more you use it, the better it gets. Indeed will also help you with some of the busy work of hiring too, like scheduling, screening, and messaging candidates. According to a survey by Indeed, 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Listeners of This Is Love will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/This Is Love. Just go to Indeed.com/This Is Love right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/This Is Love. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
The results said that I was half Japanese on my mother's side and that I was half Jewish on my father's side. It just didn't square with anything I'd been told about my family history.
Kyo had always been told that her father's family was Scottish and Irish. He had never talked about being Jewish. But her test results showed that her father's family was from Lithuania, Latvia, and Belarus.
And I remember I texted my husband. My husband's actually Jewish. And I sent him the kind of the pie chart with the ethnicity breakdown, which showed the kind of half Jewish, half Japanese. And he texted back immediately, and he was like, "You don't even like herring." And then he said, "Mazel tov, now you know what that means."
Kyo says that she was so confused by the results that she took a second DNA test. She got those results back in April, and they were exactly the same.
I realized at a certain point that, you know, the person that I would have asked had left the room, namely my father. I mean, he had just died 3 months prior. And that the only person I had left to ask was my mother. And, you know, even at the best of times, my mother is not, you know, an obliging subject.
Growing up, Kyo had always found it hard to talk to her mother. When Kyo brought her husband to meet her mother for the first time, Kyo told him, "We don't really talk about things. In our family, everything is kind of tamped down."
I think I was always a little afraid of my mother because she could turn on a dime, and like her emotions were kind of hard to read at times, and then suddenly there'd be something very explosive that would happen. In hindsight, I kind of understand it a little bit more. I think that she was very frustrated. She felt very dislocated, and also like being in a country where she didn't speak the language fluently, like that was a real barrier to her.
Sometimes Mariko would text Kyo in Japanese, and Kyo wouldn't understand. Her mother would reply, "Why don't you speak your mother language?"
In some ways, I was a kind of disappointment to my mother because I wasn't the daughter that she expected because I grew up in a biracial and bilingual home. I lost a lot of my Japanese at a very young age. So I think there was a kind of disappointment on her part that I felt very strongly.
Kyo says that her mother never understood why she loved reading books and writing her own stories. But her mother was an artist. They would go to museums and galleries together often. Mariko's favorite artists were Monet and Turner.
My mother kind of opened my eyes to seeing, you know, what there was in terms of art history and just, you know, her sense of design and composition was so beautiful. And I feel like my interest in art has kind of carried over since my childhood because of her.
Mariko owned her own gallery in Toronto that sold Japanese art. Sometimes Kyo would go with Mariko on trips to Japan to buy new pieces for the gallery. Kyo remembers her mother seemed different when she was in Japan. She smoked a lot and seemed more confident. On those trips, Mariko's family in Japan teased her for becoming too Western. Mariko was the youngest of seven children. When she was in art school, she liked fashion and going out to parties. One of Mariko's brothers told her not to be the nail that sticks out.
In many ways, she was incredibly progressive and, like, really rebellious. She had this kind of dream of leaving Japan. A lot of her friends were kind of models or actresses, and she spent a lot of time at embassy parties.
Years later, a newspaper in Toronto profiled Kyo's parents. Her father described Mariko as very strong-minded, in some ways more independent than me. Kyo's mother also had a reputation for always saying what was on her mind. At Michael's funeral, Kyo heard her mother tell someone, "I lost everything this week. I lost my husband, and I lost my Air Miles card." Kyo says that her mother was not an organized person. She knew there were a lot of details her mother didn't keep track of. When Kyo tried to talk to her mother as an adult, Mariko often avoided answering direct questions.
And so I knew that I had to find her at the right moment because I knew this was, you know, even without knowing the story, I knew this was potentially charged information. And so I got her on the phone one day and I kind of just said, you know, I've discovered this strange thing. And, you know, I remember her hesitating. She kind of put the phone down to, like, make herself a cup of tea. She came back and she was just really evasive.
Kyo tried again. She asked what the DNA results could mean. Eventually, Kyo's mother told her, "We tried for so long, for 7 years.
My mother kind of alluded to the fact that my father had had mumps as a child and was maybe sterile. She said that she'd gone to a clinic on Harley Street in London, England, and that the doctor said it would be okay. She didn't really kind of answer me in any direct way. It was just kind of evasions. I kind of guessed that there might have been a donor insemination, but it was all these, like, little fragments of information, and she wasn't actually telling me a full story.
She started wondering if Michael was not her biological father. She wanted to ask her mother more, but then Mariko was diagnosed with breast cancer.
So that kind of put everything on hold. It became clear that I needed to find somebody else to help me.
Kyo heard about a private Facebook group for people who had also found out they weren't biologically related to one of their parents after a DNA test. The group had about 8,000 members. Kyo wrote a post saying that she was looking for help with finding her biological father. A woman in San Francisco responded. She told Kyo she had experience with this kind of work. She called herself a search angel.
This is a term, like, kind of used in kind of genealogy for people who volunteer to help people who are kind of looking for their story after they've had these DNA surprises. So there's, like, a whole kind of like posse of people who volunteer their time to do this. She was in touch with me almost every day for a period of weeks.
Kyo's search angel suggested that Kyo write to the National Health Service in England to request her mother's medical records. She wanted to find out more about the fertility doctor Mariko had seen. But the NHS wrote back they couldn't find any records about a sperm donor or donor insemination for Mariko. Eventually, Kyo's search angel turned to a tool called DNA Painter that genealogists use to map shared chromosomes. She turned up five possible candidates for Kyo's biological father.
And, you know, at that point, I had this really strange feeling that I wasn't sure I wanted to find out who my father was, my biological father was. there's something so conclusive about it. It felt like literally like I was on this train and that I was going to arrive at a station, and I didn't know if it was a station I wanted to arrive at. I didn't really want to migrate out of the family that I had been raised in. I didn't want to have another father. I was, you know, I'm not at an age where I kind of need another father, but I was really curious.
Kyo Search Angel sent her a family tree with the five possibilities. They each had a number next to their name, a score of how likely it was that Kyo was related to them. Kyo started to contact relatives of those five men through the DNA test website. She wrote, "I am writing to you now with the hope that you might possess information relating to my biological father. I don't wish to intrude or upset anyone's life. I just hope to view photographs and maybe learn more about my family's medical history." One relative didn't respond. Another said he didn't want to talk. A third replied with a phone number and said to call her right away. She connected Kyo with one of her cousins. He took a DNA test, and a few weeks later he called Kyo. He told her, "The man you are looking for, he was my father."
It turned out that he was a kind of fairly famous race car driver, British race car driver.
She learned that her biological father had been married 5 times. He had a reputation for being a playboy. He was the son of Jewish refugees. He taught himself to play piano. He retired to Portugal, and he died in 2002. He had 4 other children. Kyo remembers that in the photos of her biological father, he had dark hair and a mustache. He wore sunglasses in one photo and a suit in another.
So I had these photographs, and at this point I thought, you know what, I'm going to approach my mother again. And so I remember the day really vividly. We were sitting down at the kitchen table, and I opened up my laptop, and I started to scroll through some of the photos, and I said, you know, I've discovered, you know, that I have these half-siblings. And so I was kind of just showing her the images and saying, you know, casually, like, this is my half-brother, and here's another half-brother. And then I said, and this is my father. And it was a photo of my biological father as a young man. And, you know, he was kind of strapping. He had, like, this kind of Clark Gable mustache. And my mother, I could feel her kind of, like, her breath change, and she put her hand on my knee. I was about to scroll forward, and she said, "Wait a second." And she said, "He's very handsome." And then she said, "He was very handsome." And it was like this little adjustment in the way she said it that made me realize, whoa, like, she knows this man. This is somebody she knew.
We'll be right back.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
For your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
When Kyo McClear showed her mother the picture of her biological father, Kyo wasn't sure how she would respond. But then Mariko started talking.
What she said was that it was around, I guess, 1968, and she was in London. She went to this passport office because she had to renew her passport, and she was feeling very lonely because her husband, you know, my father, the reporter, was traveling around the world, and she was alone in London. And she couldn't travel yet because she didn't have a British passport. And when she married my father, she had to renounce her Japanese citizenship. So she was in a kind of citizenship limbo where she wasn't really allowed to travel overseas. And she really wanted to go and visit her mother. So she went to this passport office and she, you know, approached the official. And they gave her forms to fill in. And, you know, I think for anyone who speaks English fluently, these forms are a complete, they're just overwhelming, right? And so for somebody who doesn't speak English as a first language, she was just kind of completely stymied. And she heard a voice from behind her say, "I can help you with that if you'd like." And she turned around and she said there was a man standing there and he offered to help. And he said, "Actually, I know you. We've met before." And he named a casino where they had met. And he mentioned that he knew my father. And they struck up a conversation. And he apparently he helped her with her passport. That's how much I got out of her the first day.
Kyo remembers suddenly feeling like she had no idea who her mother was. She also wondered if there was anything else that her parents hadn't told her.
And so I started to be suspicious of a lot of things in life. And I felt like I was ready for a jump scare at any moment. Like I thought, you know, somebody was going to tell me something else was untrue, or that I was just kind of looking for lies everywhere. Like I needed to ask every question, get every angle on the situation in order to kind of feel settled again, because I really felt completely unsettled. I kind of was like really anxious to get more information and was kind of going at her in this really interrogative way, you know, asking her a million questions and trying to pin her down. And, you know, I realized like I was very much like the reporter's daughter at this point.
After a while, Kyo realized this tactic wasn't working. During this time, Kyo and her husband started taking Mariko to her doctor's appointments for her cancer treatment. She decided to try not asking any questions for one weekend. And when she did ask, she tried to act like she wasn't interested.
We were in a waiting room a lot of the time. And so during that period of time, every now and then I would ask her another question. And every time I asked her a question, the story would change a little bit.
Her mother told her the second time she met the man from the passport office, they went out to dinner.
He owned a few restaurants around London. He was married at the time to a Japanese woman and had three children from that marriage. I guess he was quite well off.
Eventually, her mother told her that she had an affair with him. They went on dates to the movies. Sometimes they drove around the countryside. Mariko said he eventually rented her own apartment. They often traveled together while Kyo's father, Michael, was away on reporting trips. Mariko told Kyo that she found out she was pregnant in 1969, 2 years into the affair. When Kyo asked her what her biological father said when he found out she was pregnant, her mother said he would marry her. But then she said she didn't remember. Michael was away at the time, reporting on the Vietnam War.
And my mother cabled him, apparently, and said that a baby was on the way. And at that point, I don't know if he knew that I wasn't his own child, but that's as far as I got with that conversation.
Later, Kyo learned from one of her father's girlfriends that he had known. Every few years, Michael thought about telling her, but always decided it wasn't the right time. Kyo once asked her mother why she chose to stay with Michael. Mariko said, "Michael needed you. He loved you." Did knowing that your mother had had an affair change the way you saw her?
Yes, completely. In lots of ways, like on the one hand, there had been a narrative in my family that my mother was wronged and that my father was a philanderer and that she was long-suffering. And so immediately that narrative kind of was overturned. But it was actually deeper than that. It was the sense that my mother had a whole story and a whole life that I knew nothing about. And that, to me, was really thrilling to discover, I have to say, because I really underestimated my mother. Not in just this way, but like the sense that she had been this kind of background player in my life. You know, I think in the sense that women and mothers often are, and especially of a certain generation, you know, they were often, they stayed at home, they were kind of ambient, they were our backdrop. they raised us. They weren't, you know, the big protagonists often in the kind of sense that they weren't out working, especially compared with my father, who was getting all these accolades and, you know, drawing this attention as a globetrotting world reporter. You know, my mother was the stay-at-home housewife for many years. And so, you know, just discovering she had this whole other life that existed prior to my birth, that she had gone on all these adventures, that she had this like really passionate love at a certain point. It really changed my conception of her. It also changed my sense of our relationship because we'd had for many years a fairly combative relationship. It was a really painful relationship at times where I felt like there was some resentment on her part, that there's some ambivalence maybe even like about being a mother. And when I found out about this story and my mother's affair, you know, it really changed a lot because it made me think about how her ambivalence probably had something to do with the fact that, you know, I was born of this affair she had, you know, and that there was a lot of shame that she must have felt about it. And so I think, you know, maybe even subconsciously, my presence at different points probably represented something quite complicated for her. You know, for a while when I was like interrogative, it was because I thought she owed it to me. I thought she owed me my story. And at a certain point, I realized that it was also her secret and that she owed it to herself to keep something secret and that some part of the story was hers and not something that I should have.
When Keo and her husband talked with her mother about her affair and her past, Mariko would sometimes contradict herself. She said that she'd had no other affairs and that she had many boyfriends. But a few months after her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, Keo went with her to an appointment where the doctor asked if her mother had been having any memory issues.
During my mother's cancer treatment, it became clear that she wasn't following directions. Clearly, that, you know, when she was in the radiation treatment, the technician would have to repeat things many times. She was often confused. We were noticing little kind of failures in her memory, little slippages.
Mariko was diagnosed with dementia.
And it kind of put her failing or kind of slippery memories into a new light.
Keo's mother now lives in a retirement home. When Mariko first moved in, the staff told Keo that she was disruptive. They asked Keo to remind her mother to follow the residence's rules. But Mariko also became friends with a few of the other residents. She dyed her hair pink, and in art classes, she always finished her paintings by declaring finito. She told Keo, "I just want my days to be simple and peaceful." Keo decided they didn't need to talk about her birth father anymore, unless her mother wanted to.
When I realized that she had dementia and I realized that things were changing, well, first of all, I had to let go of this idea that I would ever find out the kind of, you know, facts and, you know, in this clear-cut way. And I honestly, I don't know if it's because of the dementia. Like, I don't know if that's what started it or if it's because maybe deep down she knew that I knew her secret and that I didn't judge her for it and that I, you know, in fact, I've actually had the chance to say to her, you know, I really, you know, I love you and I'm so glad I know this. And, you know, I don't know if I said that this makes me feel closer to you. Like, you know, we're not like our relationship is so not touchy-feely. So I think if I said that to her, she'd probably roll her eyes. But I did basically say that in not so many words. And so the relationship started to soften. And, you know, what that's meant is that I know that I have to make peace with the fact that I'll never know all the details of my conception or the story of my father and what he meant, my biological father, and what he meant to her. I don't know, honestly, if it was the great love of her life. Like, I have no idea, and I will never know.
Do you wish that you hadn't found out this about your family?
No, not at all. The one regret I have is that my parents hadn't told me themselves. I really wish I could have had a conversation with my father. You know, every now and then I'll go visit his grave, and the conversation I really wish that I could have had with him was that I wish I had the chance to tell him that it wouldn't have mattered at all, that he still was my father, and it wouldn't have reduced our relationship in any way. There will always be these blank spots. And I've just tried to make peace with that.
Keel McClear's memoir is called Unearthing, a story of tangled love and family secrets. This Is Love is created by Lauren Spohr and me. Nadia Wilson is our senior producer. Katie Bishop is our supervising producer. Our producers are Susanna Robertson, Jackie Sajiko, Lily Clark, Lena Sillison, and Megan Kinane. Our show is mixed and engineered by Veronica Simonetti. Learn more about the show on our website, thisislovepodcast.com, and sign up for a newsletter at thisislovepodcast.com/newsletter. You can listen to This Is Love without any ads by signing up for Criminal Plus. You'll also get to listen ad-free to our other shows, Criminal and Phoebe Reads a Mystery. Plus, you'll get bonus episodes and more. To learn more, go to thisiscriminal.com/plus. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at This Is Love Show. This Is Love is part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Discover more great shows at podcast.voxmedia.com. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.